Catholic Connection is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
You're listening to the best of Catholic Connection with Teresa Tamio.
Welcome to Catholic Connection with Teresa Tamio, keeping you connected to your faith and your world. Teresa tackles the issues of faith and culture, the pro-life message, and media awareness. And now, here's Teresa Tamio.
From our friends at Ignatius, beautiful book by Matthew Wiseman, The Two Jerusalems, My Conversion from the Messianic Movement to the Catholic Church. Matthew, welcome. I was just sharing with you my experience with some Messianic Jews who would contact me, and I worked at a Protestant station in southeastern Michigan before I went over to Catholic radio. And it was very interesting, and boy, talk about interesting. You've been on quite the journey to find yourself at home in the Catholic Church. So I know it's a long journey, and I don't want to give the book away too much because you want people to buy it, but just share with us in terms of how that journey to the Catholic Church began in the first place. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. Yeah, so when I was very young, from birth up till about 11, we were in the Baptist Church. We didn't start off as a sort of practicing Messianic, practicing Judaism or anything like that. It was a discovery, it was sort of a rediscovery of the Bible that happened for us when I was around 11 to 12 years old, where we started learning about the Old Testament more than we had ever done in the Baptist Church, and started learning about our first liturgical calendar, really, which is the one in the books of Moses. And there, from there, it grew into sort of full Torah observance as I got into my high school years.
And so, how active were you then when you got into this? Was it a very active type of a faith?
It was very active. It was much more full life than sort of our Baptist church had been, where we were serious believers even as Baptists, but that mainly looked like going to church on Sundays and then going to Bible study on Wednesday night. Whereas keeping the law of Moses, it part of the whole point in Jewish tradition is to transform your whole life, to make everything that you do religious, to make everything that you do a praise of God. So it was a complete transformation of life that we discovered daily liturgy for the first time. Well, liturgy at all, but daily liturgy for the first time. And there were rules about food and rules about clothing, and it really made your whole life part of your worship. So it was extremely active, and there was because of that, there was a strong sense of community as well.
I was going to say, so there was a real structure, because it really was built into your life. There was a structure there.
Yeah, there was three daily offices of prayer, and there were blessings for when you got up and when you got dressed and when you went to bed, and rules about human interaction and everything like that. It was a lot more structure and a lot more system than when we were Baptist.
But so you travel from there quite literally into a big synagogue in Poland, then the Judean desert, and then into the heart of Jewish tradition. You continue this. How in the world did you even come close to rethinking this whole thing and entering into the Catholic Church?
Well, they're more similar than you would think in a lot of ways. What we began to discover, the thing that made itself really apparent from this more physical, more practical way of living the faith, was that the Bible didn't really give you all of the information that you needed by itself. It really broke us from our sort of Protestant view of sola scriptura, because when you tried to keep kosher, or when you tried to follow these rules about clothing and daily prayer, you found there was a lot that wasn't spelled out very clearly in the books of Moses. And so we started turning first towards Jewish tradition and going, all right, how do people actually keep this? How do they actually observe it? And on what basis? And we learned that there was this whole tradition of an oral Torah, an oral law that accompanied the written one. and helped you to interpret and apply it. And we really found that you needed that. Otherwise, you couldn't reach any kind of agreement because of the sort of sparse nature of the text of the Bible. But there were difficulties. You know, the Jewish tradition wasn't built to be compatible with Christianity. It wasn't built to be compatible with the teachings of Jesus. It continued to develop for centuries after the time of Jesus, without contact without direct influence from Christianity. And so there were these gaps and these questions that we always had about, well, how do we fit this in with our faith in Jesus? Eventually, when I was finishing up college, I came to the conclusion that they were really irreconcilable. I couldn't put my belief in Jesus together with Jewish tradition, that there were too many points of disagreement between the two. And so that sort of left me going, I know that the Bible does not give me enough information to interpret it by itself. So I know I need a tradition, an oral tradition, but it can't be this one. And that led me back to the apostolic traditions.
In terms of your background, though, I mean, you've been exposed to so much. So in many cases, for example, if you look at the history and the life of, let's just pull out one of our great saints and one of the fathers of the church, St. Augustine, he went all over the place, right? And he was so smart, like you, and searching and searching and going here and this religion and that religion. But at the end of the day, realizes that, you know, it's Jesus and the Catholic Church. Do you find, I think your situation must be a real Romans 8:28 situation, all things working together for good, because you've had so much exposure to so much in the overall different traditions that really help you appreciate the Catholic faith even more?
Oh, definitely. And this is one of the themes of the book, I think, that I didn't write it in deliberately, but it sort of emerged as I was writing it, that I had all of these encounters all along that were directing me towards the Catholic faith when I had no idea that that was the direction I was going. In fact, I very much thought I was trying to get further and further away from traditional Christianity. But really everything was pointing me that direction. And when I realized that, it was a sort of the scale, it was a sort of moment of the scales falling off your eyes and going, oh, everything was pointing here. One of the things I make a point of in the book is that I had these fascinating encounters with Catholics and with Catholicism long before I was considering it at all, that I think were God preparing the way to bring me back to the historic faith. So yes, absolutely. And I don't think that that's unique to my story. I think that's really all of our stories. It's just that we haven't all gotten to the point where we've realized it yet, that God's always directing us back towards him and towards the true church.
Yeah. I was telling you during the break, and I can't remember if I mentioned it on air or not, but for a time I had worked at a Protestant station after coming back to the church, and there were several people there who worked at the radio station and also listeners who, when they found out I was Catholic, they were Messianic, and they're Messianic Jews, and they were very, very, very critical of the Catholic faith, and they took the same attitude as many anti-Catholic fundamentalists. Why do you think that is?
The Messianic movement as it exists today is very much a product of the Jesus movement in the 60s and 70s, which has strong ties to what it became in the charismatic movement and evangelicalism. Has very strong ties to anti-Catholic fundamentalism, but also the same stories, the same sort of myths about Catholic paganism and the Emperor Constantine have been floating around since the Reformation, and they're very much in the DNA of the Protestant movement. And even I still have, you know, friends who are Protestant ministers, and even the best educated among them, they find that they're having to fight in their own congregations against misinformation. Even though they're not Catholics, they go, well, these are not good arguments. Mm-hmm. So I think it's sort of baked in, those same myths, the same misleading stories. They come down to us all the way from, you know, the 15th and 16th centuries.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they just, it's really hard to root them out once they've dug in.
So for whom did you write the book? I'm sure it was somewhat of a catharsis to tell your story, but you know, what type of readers, Matthew, do you hope will pick up this book?
As I was, especially in the editing process, I was really hoping to make it accessible to Catholics, to help them understand that I do think this is a growing movement, a Messianic and Hebrew roots movement, and I find more and more people that I encounter ask me, can you tell me about this movement so that I know. Committed Catholics weren't considering joining it, but I've got a friend who's thinking about it, and I don't know what to tell them. I'm hoping to make it accessible to Catholics to help them understand what this is and be prepared to answer it. But also I wanted to make it accessible to people who are in the Hebrew Roots movement or are considering it and see how the Jewish roots of the faith really point to the historic church, to the Catholic Church, not to these sort of Reconstructionist movements, which often misunderstand the historical data and especially the biblical data that they're looking at.
So how would you describe, though, the Messianic movement? Because there's different factions of it. You have Jews who convert to Christianity and become Messianic. They're called themselves Messianic Jews, and those are the ones with whom I dealt with and had some run-ins with in my time, in my short time in Protestant radio. And then there's people who want to embrace a lot of the traditions, but they're still Christian. How do you describe the movement overall?
It's very difficult to come up with one description of what I've come to is the only thing that they really have in common is that it's a movement of believers in Jesus who believe that the law of Moses applies to their life. And that's really about all they have in common as a whole movement. There are those who are Gentiles who believe that all believers have an obligation to keep the law of Moses. Some of them keep it very much, they take a Protestant view and they view Scripture alone, and some a much more sort of traditional Jewish view with the oral law and the Midrash and all of these traditional interpretations. And like you said, there are Messianic Jews, and some of them believe that the law of Moses is a requirement for them to keep because they are Jewish converts, but they wouldn't apply the same rules to Gentiles who are believers. And then there are others who are more or less evangelical Christians or even Catholics who just want to keep some of their Jewish heritage because they see that it's an enriching part of their lives. And so it's a very, very diverse movement, and it's very hard to pin down.
Yeah, that's very true. So in terms of the response to the book, how's it doing, and what do you hope to do in terms of you out in the speaking circuit? What are you hoping to do with the book, Matthew?
The responses are still sort of getting started. We've just started promoting in over the last month, so I've gotten one or two Amazon reviews, but I haven't gotten a whole lot of feedback yet. So I'm excited to hear what people think, and hope to people will reach out and will share reviews so I know how it's being received. I am a high school teacher, so during the year, the speaking circuit is a little bit beyond my reach. I'm doing a lot of radio promoting and podcasts and things like that. Things that I can do from home are sort of my bread and butter on promoting. I'm really hoping to start a conversation. That's what I want to do. When I was in the Messianic movement, we never talked even really to serious Catholics because we thought Catholicism was so obviously pagan, so obviously beyond the pale that it wasn't a serious consideration. My big hope is to be able to foster a conversation about Scripture and tradition and what it really means to embrace the Jewish roots of the Christian faith.
Isn't it interesting the journey the Lord takes you on, and then you end up being Catholic, and now you're... I just love it, though, but I think it's great. I think you have such a great background, such a diverse background, and that could be so, so helpful in helping people, you know, even in your, I think you're a teacher. Who knows? You may be teaching the faith very soon in some ways. Matthew, thank you, and God bless you. I hope this is a big success. Matthew Wiseman, brand new book, The Two Jerusalems, from our friends at Ignatius Press, My Conversion from the Messianic Movement to the Catholic Church. We'll be right back. Thanks, Matthew.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Steve Ray here. Next year's a Jubilee year, and we're going to celebrate it in Rome. But not only Rome. This is our Saints and Shrines of Italy pilgrimage, and joining us is our good friend Teresa Tomeo.
Yes, Steve, fantastico. Walking through the holy doors, immersing ourselves in the deeply Catholic culture of Italy. I'll be joining you and Janet in Florence and Assisi.
Join us this May for the Jubilee year, from Milan to Florence and much more, all the way to Rome.
Find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at avemariaradio.net.
People ask how they can care for older family members who can't fully care for themselves. One answer is Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Visiting Angels assists adults nationwide with 600 locations to continue living at home and not have to move into a nursing home. Their caregivers provide assistance in hygiene, meals, and light housework. Services are provided up to 24 hours per day, and you can select your caregiver before service begins. More information, including franchise opportunities, is on the web at visitingangels.com.
This show is underwritten in part by the following nonprofit company.
My dear brothers and sisters, I'm Bishop Gerald Vinke of the Diocese of Salina in Kansas. This year, you can create a Christmas miracle for a child growing up in the extreme poverty of a developing country. By donating to Send a Box of Joy, you will surprise a child with what could be the first Christmas gift of his or her life. You can bless a child today by donating at boxofjoy.org.
You're listening to the best of Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
Welcome back, Catholic Connection. It is a Thursday morning. So a couple of really interesting stories to discuss with the one, the only, Father Mitch Pacwa for our cultural connections. And Father, this really, the two stories are actually connected, because one of the reasons I encourage people to take pilgrimages so much is because they get to see the lives of the saints. And sometimes we put the saints up on a pedestal and think they never had any struggles, or think that the church should be perfect or was perfect. I'm talking about not the church teachings, obviously. Those are from Christ and are always perfect. But in terms of the history of the church and the problems in the church, so there's this new letter that was just released from the Pope. Church history cannot be reduced to mere chronological facts. And the Holy Father is trying to get us to understand what's happened in the past so we can have a realistic view of the human person and how we react in the church. Let me just read you a quick summary. The Pope releasing a letter today on the importance of studying church history, saying it can protect us from an overly angelic conception of the church, presenting a church that is unreal because she lacks spots and wrinkles. Church history, he says, helps us to see the real church and to love the church as she truly exists and love what she has learned and continues to learn from her mistakes and failures. So your thoughts. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Well, my pleasure as always. One of the things about having this understanding of the importance of history is that, you do see the spots and wrinkles. You see the difficulties. That's real in the history of the church, as it is in everything else. And there is a goofy attitude that a lot of people have, thinking that if there is imperfection in an historical character, that that character can be canceled. This has been going on in the study of American history quite a bit. We see people who are, rejecting various historical characters because they are so flawed. This is something that's not that big a scandal for Catholics from this perspective, that we expect people to be sinners. My Bible tells us all we like sheep have gone astray and turned to our own ways. This is the reality of human existence. And I think to keep in mind that studying that history is important. It's a history of sin that includes us, like those who are on the more mature side of things can remember the old cartoon called Pogo. And the famous line from Pogo was, "We have met the enemy, and they is us." because the story of sin is our story. And we can't, you know, we're with the sinners. And that's all we got. That's what we are. And that's okay. We can cope with that. But at the same time, let me use an example from my own life. My father was absolutely opposed to me being a priest. And when I told him and my mother back when I was 16 that I was planning to become a Jesuit, he said, when I was 16, that the day you become a Jesuit priest, that's the day you're out of my will. And he did. He disinherited me. Well, I couldn't have kept it anyway. Now, I was too much, as much of a smart mouth as I am. I didn't say that. I thought it, but I didn't say it. Now, here's part of the thing he did. When I was studying philosophy, he said, "I dare you to read this book." It was called The Bad Popes. And so he gave it to me, and I read it. Next time I saw him, he said, "You didn't read that book, did you?" I said, "Yes, I did. I loved it." And he said, "What?" I said, "Yes, because, A, I learned two things I only roughly knew. One, none of the bad popes made dogma, so they didn't undo the church.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, so didn't go at infallibility. We never taught that the popes are impeccable. Impeccable means that you cannot sin. Of course they can sin, and they do. And you see that in this book and other books about different popes. But secondly, the bad popes were followed by reform popes. So after the worst period was the 10th century, the 900s, into the early 1000s. That was the pits of papal history. But it was followed by St. Gregory the VII and a number of reform cardinals and bishops. And this happened at every step of the way, that the bad popes were followed by holy ones. Pope Pius V comes up, you know, after there had been a lot of these early Renaissance popes that were really bad. But this is how the Holy Spirit works in the church. And you can see that the sin is real. And throughout the history of the church, it frequently looks as if sin is going to defeat the church, and it never does. We live out the reality of, you know, what happened to Christ himself. He was crucified. People lied about him. They condemned him twice on conflicting charges. The Sanhedrin said he claimed to be God, so we condemn him. And then they accuse him before Pilate of trying to be a human king instead of being God. Didn't matter, conflicting charges. They got him killed. It looked like he was done. His disciples were scattered and denying knowing him. And yet, the resurrection took place, and the Holy Spirit came and reformed the apostles. And they made them not only the pillars of the church, the foundation stone of the church, as both St. Paul says in Ephesians 2:10, but also in the book of Revelation. They are the foundation of the church, despite themselves. This goes on. So I would be absolutely in favor and of studying more history. Now, I have to also say this as a little sidebar. A lot of history books are deadly boring. I mean, these are like dental drills into your teeth. They're so dull. Having gone to graduate school, I acquired a high level of enculturation to boredom. It's one of the best things you learn out of graduate school. You become enculturated to lots of boredom. But the way that I would recommend people do this kind of study is to take a look at the lives of saints. Not kids' books on it. I mean, that's fine for you if you're a kid. But there are serious books that study the great saints of the church. And read those. And you don't only learn about that individual, but you start to be able to see the points of the whole background of their life and what was going on. And a great window into church history.
Let's talk more about that after the break with two new saints being canonized next year. Father Mitch Pacwa joining us this morning.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
The devil will always do his best to tempt you into sin until you get to that place where you love sin. That's what he wants. He wants you down there with him. And not because he loves you, he hates you. When you do what the enemy tempts you to do, he does it out of pure hatred.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
How can we be sure our conscience is guiding us rightly? The Catholic Catechism states that in order to make correct moral judgments, we must have a well-formed conscience, one that is upright, truthful, and formulates its judgments according to reason and conforms them to the true good willed by the wisdom of the Creator. In order to avoid the trap of negative influences and the desire to prefer our own judgments, we must educate our conscience. The Catechism asserts that prudent education teaches virtue and guarantees freedom and engenders peace of heart. What are the ingredients of this educational stew? The Word of God, which we absorb through faith and prayer and an examination of conscience before the Lord's cross. Though our modern world sometimes makes discernment difficult, a well-formed conscience helps us see what is right and choose what is the will of God as expressed in divine law. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Do you have a teenager at home who's full of potential? Too often the world is telling you to be content with mediocrity instead of raising respectful and responsible young adults with strong character. Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. Ray. If you need some help, not only to navigate those teen years, but to really enjoy them, check out my book, Standing Strong, Good Discipline Makes Great Teens, as well as my other books, on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net.
You're listening to the best of Catholic Connection with Teresa Tamia.
Having a great conversation, as we always do, thanks be to God, the wisdom of Father Mitch Pacwa, our very own from EWTN. Commenting first on the Pope releasing a letter on church history, which is so important. And Father, you and I were discussing during the break, you and I do a lot of pilgrimages and have in the past. And I really think it's important for folks to think about at some point to do a pilgrimage to, let's say, Poland or Italy, or God willing, if we can ever get them started again. And I hope it's sooner than later, to the Holy Land. Because when you are walking in the footprints of the saints, no matter where you are, especially in a place like Italy where obviously the faith is based, you not only learn about the saints, but you learn about their lives, what they were up against in terms of the culture, in terms of, as you mentioned before, problems in the church. And it makes you feel, I think, very strong because you realize that, as it says in Ecclesiastes, there's nothing new under the sun. And what we're dealing with now in many ways pales in comparison to what some of these saints had to deal with. And now we have two new saints that are going to be canonized next year, both very dynamic young men. Blessed Pier Giorgio Frassati from northern Italy, from the Torino area, where he's buried at St. John the Baptist Church. And then, of course, Carlo Cutis, who always is, of course, is from the north. He was born in Milan, then moved to England, then moved back.
No, he was born in London.
London, that's right. You're right. Born in London, then he stayed in England and then came back for a while and was raised in the Milan area. But he's buried in Assisi at St. Mary Major. two very dynamic young men born in very different times, but in many ways difficult times, right?
100%. And, you know, connection with the media is with both of them. Pier Giorgio's dad was a newspaper editor, founder of a newspaper, and Carlo Acutis started working in the internet. And I think to pay attention, some people, I just had a great call on my radio show yesterday where a lady was saying, wait a minute, we've got this really wonderful holy woman down in South Louisiana. Why isn't she being canonized? And these guys are getting fast-tracked. Well, one of the issues is that, you know, we depend on God's grace to do the miracles required for canonization. That's his action, not ours. Secondly, we also, might work on areas where there is a greater need. And in this case, the way that young people, I get to have great conversations here at the network, and there was a guest on Life on the Rock this past week who was just brilliant in the way he sees that the reason the church is losing so many young people to the faith is they don't have a small community where they belong. Family is broken up, or family is never even started. You read about the language is really bad, but the story of J.D. Vance's life is a classic example of American total breakdown of family and terrible consequences. But other groups helped him to, you know, deal with this. This is something that is very, very important to say that we have these new modern young saints who might be able to help young people today relate to the issues they have. The concern for social justice that we've seen among our college students are really good. But we also saw them go in goofy ways because they wanted systemic changes, they wanted this big deal change, and society has to change, all this. And whereas Pier Giorgio had such a wonderful sense that he loved the poor people. He himself took care, and he suffered for them rather than inflicting suffering by causing riots the way Antifa did back in 2020. That you have to deal with the concerns for the poor, but you don't do it in a way that actually harms others, including the poor. There's an example there, as well as the joy he had, as opposed to the anger that so many have. This is a good antidote. And the same with Acutis. We have, you know, 95% of college kids are looking at the internet for porn every week. We need a holy young man who used the internet to gather good information and to evangelize. It's not that the internet is evil, but there are really big sinners who are using the internet to make a lot of money on the souls of other people, that they don't care about putting other souls at risk. They just want to make money, and people fall for that rope-a-dope scene. We want to be people who say, no, the internet is a way to sanctity and holiness. And this is something that's very, very important. So that's why the fast-tracking is so important. And plus, you know, a couple significant miracles have been attributed to the intercession of Carlo Acutis and, of course, Pier Giorgio. And both of them are capturing the imaginations of so many young groups. And that's exactly the kind of antidote to the loss of faith going on in our culture, where people don't have groups, but now young adult groups are naming themselves after Pier Giorgio and Carlo Acutis, and they're forming around a saint that, you know, inspires them. We need inspiring individuals as we form communities that support us especially at this time when family's broken down. And it's important to note that for both of those young men, their families were not that practicing. Their families had been very sick. They got baptized and all this, but they weren't practicing the faith. But especially in the case of Carlo Acutis, he helped his mother and his father by his questions and his concerns about bigger issues, and even by his suffering in a relatively short illness, he had leukemia, and it took his life fairly quickly.
Yeah, 15 he was when he died.
But also that the disease onset was something that happened fairly quickly. You know, a slight misdiagnosis that was then corrected, but it was already too late. And he offered his suffering and for others, and it really helped his parents to come back to the faith. These are the kind of things where people find themselves very depressed because of their suffering. Because people are really suffering. They're not depressed just because life is just a bowl of cherries. They're depressed because they don't have any meaning, they don't see God in their lives, and they don't know whom they can trust to live authentic Christianity, and they see fakes. We saw the priest crisis, we see various ministers, you know, with their moral crises, and so whom can they trust? And here you have a couple of young men who become holy in the midst of it. And, of course, we had St. Maria Goretti, a young Italian girl.
Hey, what's with all these Italians? I'm just saying.
All right, so the headquarters. They get a fast track.
I'm just saying. Father, great. I wish we had more time. We will continue this discussion, though, because there's so much to talk about with these two brand-new saints to be canonized next year, and, of course, church history as well. We'll be right back on a Thursday. Stay tuned.
'60 on 10 with Monsignor Charles Pope.
The Second Commandment. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. The disclosure of a name in the ancient world belonged to the order of trust and intimacy, and so when God revealed his name to Moses, it was an extraordinary outreach to us, saying that we were called to an intimate, trusting relationship with him. And so we should always reverence this name as a great gift. We should obviously never use God's name to curse or to blaspheme or to berate others. God's name is meant to bring blessing. And likewise, the vain use. Vain means empty. So some of these expressions like, oh my God, or, you know, and so on, need to be avoided as well. Vain means empty, and those are using God's name as an empty kind of expression of exasperation. And then finally, never ever to use God's name to swear an oath falsely. God is the God of truth. The Second Commandment, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain.
For more about the Ten Commandments, visit EWTNRC.com.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
John, chapter 8, verse 51. Jesus is in a discussion with some of the leaders of the Jews. They're talking about Abraham. Abraham lived 1,500 years before the time of Jesus. So in the course of the discussion, Jesus says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death." He says that often in the Gospels. "He who keeps my word or believes in me will never die." To which the Jews say, "Now we know you have a demon." And they say, "Abraham died, as did the prophets. All the patriarchs, the great men and women of the history of Israel. All these people died, and you say, if anyone keeps my word, he will never taste death? Are you greater than our father Abraham, who died? And the prophets, who died?" And Jesus says, "Your father Abraham rejoiced that he was to see my day. He saw it and was glad." To which the Jews say, "You are not yet 50 years old, and you've seen Abraham?" And Jesus answers, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am."
You're listening to the best of Catholic Connection with Teresa Tamio.
Wrapping up a Thursday with one of my favorite people, great writer and speaker, Joseph Pierce is with us. Brand new book, Classic Literature Made Simple, 50 Great Books in a Nutshell. Joseph, how are you, my friend? Good to talk to you.
I'm doing very well. Good to talk to you as always, Teresa.
All right, so how did you put this all into one book? That's my question. My first question.
Well, Yeah, so the book began as a series for Crisis Magazine. I was writing a series for them, 50 great books in a nutshell. And when I got to the 50 and I finished it, then I asked Ignatius Press, well, put all these together in a book, would you publish them? They said yes. So the idea of it is really to allow people that don't perhaps know literature as well as they would like to get an overview of 50 of the great works of Western civilization, but literally in a nutshell. So each book's only 1,000 or so words, so it's not going to overburden anybody with anything too heavy. I hope it's going to be an appetizer, you know, for those that want to go a bit deeper.
Okay, so highlight, I know we can't go through, obviously, all of them, but highlight some of your favorites that you've included in this latest book of yours, Classic Literature Made Simple.
Well, that's a great question. Obviously, I like them all. But as you say, we can't talk about them all. I'll select, for instance, that there's a Flannery O'Connor, the great American writer, wrote, she's best known for her short stories, but she wrote a couple of novels, and I love her novel, The Violent Bear of the Way, because this is the genius of Flannery O'Connor. The hero of that novel is a child with poverty with Down syndrome, so mentally handicapped child, and the way the behavior suggests a child with Down syndrome. I'm a parent of a son with Down syndrome, and she makes this child with Down syndrome the Christ figure, because he is the innocent victim of the sins of all the others who don't see the point of him, who resent the fact he exists because he's a burden, etc. So he's abused by these you know, wicked characters in the novel, and in so doing, and I won't spoil it by saying what happens at the end, but. But in so doing, you know, that he emerges as the innocent victim of the sins of others. And insofar as that's the case, we have the child with Downs as a figure of Christ. And that's a stroke of genius, and obviously very much a pro-life stroke of genius, which it was hard for me to read as the parent of someone with a Down syndrome child. But I love the fact that she was, you know, looking at the dignity of the human person in the handicapped child, and the fact that as the innocent victim of the sins of others is ipso facto if united with Christ on the cross.
Beautiful. I'm reading a quote here regarding the book and the release that came with it. Christian civilization, I love this, is what you say, has given birth to numerous great books as it has given birth to numerous great saints. The former should be canonized as well as the latter. Great books, like great saints, enrich our faith as they enrich our culture. As such, reading good books should be an integrated part of leading a good life. Why don't we read enough anymore, do you think, Joseph?
Yeah, well, I think the problem, Teresa, is that we live in a world of just multifarious distractions. We're all plugged in to so many different gadgets. And my concern is that our gadgets, you know, for many of us, become gadgets. You know, we spend more time with our gadgets than we do with our God. So I think one good thing about reading, as we're playing, is it takes us away from those distractions, which are a bit like a dust storm in a desert, and allows us an oasis of silence where we can actually reconnect with the more important things, which, of course, is the presence of God in our lives and to understand the presence of God in our neighbors.
I wanted to share with you, speaking of quotes, this quote from the Holy Father on his latest encyclical, which was released today in the Sacred Heart, and reminds me of what you're saying in that quote and what you're telling us right now. It's a very powerful quote. Living as we do, he says, in an age of superficiality, rushing frenetically from one thing to another without really knowing why, and ending up as insatiable consumers and slaves to the mechanisms of a market unconcerned about the deeper meaning of our lives. All of us need to rediscover the importance of the heart. And I think, obviously, in addition to reading scripture and about the lives of the saints, but good books can help us get back to that, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely, which is why I said that, you know, that I talked at the beginning of the book about there being four types of books: good books, good bad books, bad good books, and bad bad books. And in other words, a book could be good in terms of being well written as a work of art, but also good in terms of the moral and philosophy and the Christianity that it exudes. So we really need to be able to discern those books which are good as literature, but also good as Christian works of art. And that's what I try to do in the book, because I've basically selected these books which I think are good books, and therefore should be read and should be canonized. There is a canon of the great books, and there should be.
Talking with Joseph Pierce, of course, author, publisher, editor, and instructor. His website is jpierce.com. And I want to talk a little bit more about some of the other books in your book. So we have the one from Flannery O'Connor. What else would you say is among your favorites in your collection here?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a great lover of William Shakespeare, and many people sort of find him intimidating. They think he's difficult, largely because I think they were taught it badly when they were perhaps at high school, and I've never sort of been able to revisit it. So there's 7 Shakespeare plays in there, and what I'm hoping, again, by just concentrating on the fact, just 1,000 words, looking at the gist, the real heart of the morality and the Christianity of these plays, that I can rekindle, maybe kindle for the first time, a love for this great Catholic playwright who's certainly one of the greatest writers of all time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I had Shakespeare in high school. I really liked it. I didn't pick it up as much as I should have once I got to college because I was studying journalism. But the messages and the meaning of so many things, I still remember many quotes from many of the Shakespeare's plays, and I really enjoyed it. The book is Classic Literature Made Simple by our friend Joseph Pierce. So, Joseph, most people are familiar with your profound conversion to Catholicism. When did you first take such an interest in literature, in books and reading? What sparked that for you? Go back for us, if you would.
Yeah, well, you know, I had a very bad formal education at high school in England, but my father was a keen reader. He left school at 14. He was a carpenter, so worked in construction, but he was bibliophilically self-taught. I mean, he loved literature. He could quote swathes of Shakespeare. So I really loved literature, learned to love literature from my father's knee, and it saved me, because I was a bad boy when I was young, got myself in all sorts of trouble. I was very anti-Christian, very anti-Catholic. But the fact that I love reading, I think in the end was going to save me under grace. Of course, everything's under grace, you know. So I discover writers such as G.K. Chesterton and C.S. Lewis, and eventually St. Thomas Aquinas and St. Augustine. And so my love of reading basically brought me to the church. So I say to people, you write as well as you read, but you also think as well as you read. So if we don't read well, we won't think well. If we don't think well, mm-hmm. we're going to be going strange directions.
So if you were, you probably had this question before, but this popped into my head. If you were left on a desert island, or somebody pushed you off from Naples, Florida, where you're near, right off Emory University, into the ocean, and you had to take one book with you, one or two books, which books would it be?
Well, obviously, everybody knows we're going to say the Bible, so we'll put that to one side, so to speak. I cheat when people ask me that question. I cheat because what I say is I'll take the collective works of William Shakespeare. That should keep me busy for a while. Is that cheating, though?
Okay, what else? I'm going to press a little bit. There's got to be something else. Name another one.
The Dorothy L. Sayers translation and notes of Dante's Divine Comedy I take with me as well, I think.
Ah, okay. All right. Now, in terms of the response to this book, how do you want people to receive it? Obviously, you're giving them highlights, but the goal, and I think on your heart's probably read more, take up these this classic literature, really open your heart to it, open your mind to it in this busy, busy world in which we live.
Exactly. So I'm hoping that this is an easy access to these great works, and if they read the book, and you don't have to read it in any particular order, you can open it anywhere and read about any of them, but I'm hoping that at least some of them will be appetizers, and some say, that's interesting, I'm going to go and buy the book, and actually don't just read my 1,000 words on it, but they're going to actually read the book itself. So if my book serves as an appetizer, which leads people to go to the works themselves, I will consider that it's a job well done.
And in terms of what you're working on next, now this is, you put this together, and it's from a series that you did, but will there be a follow-up to this? Because I'm sure you have a lot of other books you'd like to recommend to people.
Yeah, I mean, I could carry on writing these sorts of books forever, but also, you know, I want to write something on the understanding words in the culture wars. You know, we need to defend the definite meanings. So there are so many different things. I've been writing works of history, works on literature, and now I want to engage, if you like, up to a point, the culture wars. So, yeah, I've always got, I mean, when I say to people, when I die, there will be hundreds of books I wanted to read and didn't, and dozens of books I wanted to write and didn't, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. I just do what I can until I reach the finishing line, and hopefully God will tell me I've been a good and faithful servant at that point, God willing.
Amen to that. Talking with author and speaker and editor Joseph Pierce, his latest book from Ignatius, Classic Literature Made Simple, 50 Great Books in a Nutshell. In terms of really helping people get interested, I have to say that when I had a very, very good Catholic education, grade school education. Of course, I fell away from the faith for a long time, but that was my fault, not theirs. And I had wonderful teachers who talked to us about reading and brought to life short stories, great short stories, and also great books. And I think that really made an impression on me and really, I think, got me interested in writing. So how important is that, Joseph, to start at a younger age in reading, interest in reading?
I think it's crucial. And my parents never read to me, and I realized, you know, that was a vacuum in my childhood. On the other hand, my wife and I both spent many, many hours reading to our own children. And I think, first of all, that's a great bonding time for parent and child. But it also, this is how our children, their imagination is baptized by being immersed in these great works of children's literature, obviously, when they're young, and then the books become more grown up as they grow up. And this is a great way of nurturing their love of story, their love of God, their ability to articulate our ideas. And that's crucial, because then they'll be hit with lots of nonsense, you know, in our day with all the spin you see in the media. And I think reading great literature allows people to be able to think clearly and coherently and cohesively. And that's really, really essential at that age. As I said, you only write as well as you read, and you only think as well as you read. So reading well is crucial.
And I think the younger you do it, the better, because I know that I'm working with my grandnieces who are now 8 years old, and I'm trying to give them good Catholic books to read, especially about the saints. And I think I have a winner, because I've been talking to them, because, you know, Deacon Dom and I spend a lot of time in Italy, especially in Umbria. And so I told them all about the Wolf of Gubbio and St. Francis, and I found a great book at one of the churches in Assisi that was written in English about the Wolf of Gubbio and St. Francis. Now they're fascinated with St. Francis, they're fascinated with the Wolf of Gubbio, and they want to learn all about it. So that was just talking to them about which, according to tradition, did happen in Gubbio many, many centuries ago. But just kind of letting them know about these stories that are actually real stories is a way, I think, to pique a young person's interest.
Absolutely. You said the lives of the saints are crucial, and the lives of saints are children. And that these books are written for children of all ages. So you're right. You should start really, quite frankly, start reading for children from the beginning, because I think they, even a baby likes the music of the parent's voice, even if that baby doesn't understand what's being said. And then that they will just grow into that comprehension, but then will be used to the fact that they're having this music, the music of the human voice as the parents reading to them. So really it should start from birth, and I know some people say it should start before then, you know.
Yes, I'm just going to say that. There's research to show that they recognize your voice, they hear things in the womb. You read when they're in the womb.
Exactly, as I say. So not even before that, even in utero, because they do hear the voice and that. So beginning from the beginning, right? And so that they're completely immersed in this as part of what is natural to them, because right from the very beginning, they've been given this engagement with the power of the words and storytelling and the beauty of poetry, and also the bonding with the parent. I mean, it's just a win-win-win-win-win situation.
Yeah. Well, thank you for helping us with that, because you do such a great job. You're a wonderful author, speaker, and editor. The latest book from our friend Joseph Pierce, Classic Literature Made Simple, 50 Great Books in a Nutshell, from our friends at Ignatius Press. Thanks, Joseph. Great to have you on the program again.
My pleasure. God bless you.
Okay, you too. And we'll be right back on a Thursday morning edition of Catholic Connection. Stay tuned. Catholic Connection is sponsored by House of Joppa. House of Joppa's mission is to share the beauty of our one holy Catholic and apostolic faith in our homes through Catholic home decor, art, candles, statues, rosaries, and Catholic jewelry. They're gifts designed to help you live out your Catholic faith. For more information, go to houseofjoppa.com. That's houseofjoppa, JOPPA.com.
More of Catholic Connection coming up on EWTN and Ave Maria Radio.
People ask how they can care for older family members who can't fully care for themselves. One answer is Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Visiting Angels assists adults nationwide with 600 locations to continue living at home and not have to move into a nursing home. Their caregivers provide assistance in hygiene, meals, and light housework. Services are provided up to 24 hours per day, and you can select your caregiver before service begins. More information, including franchise opportunities, is on the web at visitingangels.com.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will, and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
This show is underwritten in part by the following nonprofit company.
My dear brothers and sisters, I'm Bishop Gerald Vinke of the Diocese of Salina in Kansas. This year, you can create a Christmas miracle for a child growing up in the extreme poverty of a developing country. By donating to Send a Box of Joy, you will surprise a child with what could be the first Christmas gift of his or her life. You can bless a child today by donating at boxofjoy.org.
Thanks so much for tuning in to Catholic Connection, co-produced by, of course, Ave Maria Radio and EWTN. Find us both online. That's AveMariaRadio.net and EWTN.com. And please pray for your local Catholic radio affiliate. And you know what? If there's not one in your area, pick one. Go to EWTN.com and go to radio and see all the affiliates all over the country. And if you can, as Mother Angelica always said, and as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, as Father Mitch still says, keep all of us between your gas and electric bills, because we work together with our 400-plus affiliates and the network to bring you Catholic programming 24/7. Speaking of which, tomorrow is a Friday, and that means the one, the only Doug Keck will be joining me, as he always does on Fridays, for our Inside Word, giving you an update on what's coming up. And they're going to have a lot of election coverage and the wrap-up of the Synod, of course. That's coming up. And then we'll also have Fact Check Friday and more news on what's happening in the world. Thanks so much again for tuning in to Catholic Connection, and we will talk to you tomorrow, God willing, on a Friday. Ciao, ciao.
You've been listening to Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo. Catholic Connection is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Our producer is Andrew Kruchek. For copies of this program or for more information, visit AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net. Thanks for listening, and join us next time for another edition of Catholic Connection.